Kala'im der Eretz, which for her, as opposed to others, meant the suppression of the traditional ways of studying Torah, in particular, the suppression of the existence of the yeshiva as an integrated institution, and the notion of a separate community, a coherent, self-organized body, were part and parcel of the same picture.
Great reputation sounds almost like the beginning of yeshiva. I suffer personally hearing say that he wants to educate Al-Bakr, but fully versed in not necessarily rabbi.
But he had a yeshiva.
That was a different.
Yeah, he combined it.
Rebel, I think, had a much more intelligent program because anti-elitism carries within itself the seed. Well, there's a lot of everybody wants to do something and encounters a lot of opposition. That's not the problem. The issue here was that Hirsch built a self-limiting institution. It could exist for two or three generations. But then it became sterile.
Checkers.
Right, exactly. So,
you're one of them, though.
If we, for example, look on page, in this article, there's several things that I want to read from this article by Arendt, which there's another article in this book. Go to page 135. In 1924, Rabbi Yaakov Rosenheim wrote an article, and it's and there is a chapter in it called "The Spiritual Productivity of Orthodoxy." He's describing German Orthodoxy. He says the spokespeople of the rabbi. He was a publicist. The spokespeople for Orthodox Judaism in Germany, says Rosenheim, are all counted either amongst the students of Hirsch or amongst the students of Hildesheim. Remember, Hildesheimer had a more scientific program. That is, he was interested in the science of Judaism, provided that it doesn't exceed a certain limit, namely that, and produced, did create a seminar for rabbis and had a number of very great rabbinical scholars and great rabbanim there, such as Hoffman and Berliner. And eventually Rabbi Weinberg. So all of these, but this is what Rosenheim writes. All of them are measured amongst either the students of Hirsch or the students of Hildesheim. And both of these groups exemplify sterility and epigonetism. That is intellectual sterility or simply following the path that's been set by others, without any ability of independent creativity. They are barren, not capable of any type of spiritual creativity, or to build some kind of synthesis in the fields of metaphysics, ethics, or aesthetics, and they go back and grind the same flour that was ground by their teachers. Here and there, there's some tiny little novelty in what they write, some original statement which is successful, but it doesn't reach any degree of wavy creativity. So here's a spokesman for the Agoda actually making this. He was certainly connected with it. And he was, and to see even within the Hirsch's community, let's turn to the next page. Saying that the younger students who have then opened up to the attraction of the Eastern European yeshivot, who did not have this ideal of Torah and Derech Eretz, and this slightly indented portion on the bottom of the page, Their slogan was, for 100 years, we wasted time on the experiment to marry Torah and European culture. Nonsense. Let's return to Torah and Talmud, to Musar and Hasidut, and only them. We have, the European culture has nothing to give us, it just takes something from us. There is only a certain amount of value to technology, to specialized knowledge, in other words, the outside forms of civilization, but they don't have any internal value, any spiritual value whatsoever. So this is a common theme that we certainly hear today. And let's turn to page 143, where there is a criticism by Yosef Wolgamut. I assume that's Rabbi Wolgamut's father. Right. In writing a devastating critique of Rabbi Breuer's book, let's turn to on 143, the next to the bottom page. The main claim of Wolgamut and his criticism of the book is that it doesn't have any thesis, that doesn't have any ability to convince someone who's not already convinced. In any event, neither the man of science who feels that there's some problems and lives the contradictions and is tortured by them, certainly will not be convinced, he says, by Breuer's book. Breuer, Wolgamut claims, deals with matters which are very far from him with some type of cold philosophical viewpoint. And this is not surprising. Anyone who knows his treatment of other difficult and painful things, like justifying evil and so on, understands seriously. And how, let me just turn to the in other words, the complaint here is that return to the top of page 145. How much time do I have left? I want to really get on to another topic here. More or less. All right. What we don't find in literature that's written in German is the idea that Rav Shemshon Lefarheh wrote explicitly in a letter written in Hebrew to Rav Pinchas Moshe Nachman Wexler, which was published recently, about 10 years ago for the first time, and that is that Chazal did not claim to teach scientific facts, but they spoke according to the knowledge of their time and only tried to adopt to any scientific fact, an educational or a Torah interpretation. In other words, not any one of the followers of Hirsch reached to the level of daring that the teacher himself, when he taught that Emunat Chachamim does not obligate ourselves to believe in the scientific truth of various statements that are made by Chazal in the fields of biology, cosmogony, and so on. As he wrote, for example, in connection to, and then he quotes the thing that we quoted last time about the spine turning into a snake, and so on. Let's finish with this idea that practically we don't find at all in amongst the writings of the Orthodox in Germany, if I'm not mistaken, and that is there are many religious scientists who live with us today who treat the contradictions between science and religion according to what Professor Yeshaya Leibowitz has been teaching in these last 20 years, namely that these two fields should have nothing to do with one another, that they just simply apply to different domains and they don't touch one another. Of course, but even this kind of a statement, he says in the last sentence, we don't find. But when in the middle of the 19th century, Dr. Mendel Hirsch wrote a series of statements on the problems of the Jewish school and tried to develop a Jewish teaching method, someone from Hamburg who signed himself A.M. Cohen complained, and relying on the Igaret Safon wrote, one, that the Torah doesn't teach us any scientific knowledge. Two, this is not true that that a choice is either the Torah is true or the science is true. Sometimes science teaches us how to explain the Torah in the correct way. 3, there is nothing in the book of Genesis which should be interpreted as a history of creation. One should reach to the spirit of the Torah and not to try to deal with imagined contradictions between what is written and science. Every explanation that is made has to be presented as a subjective one and definitely shouldn't be imposed. Dr. Mendel Hirsch responded bitterly and very aggressively to this. He attacked him, etc. And it seems to me that not only was the person who called himself Cohen right in this debate by Mendel Hirsch, but this person from Hamburg spoke in the spirit of Rav Shemshon Lefer Hirsch more than that of his son. Rav himself, at that time, was the rabbi in Frankfurt, the director of the school, and still the editor of the journal Shurin, but he didn't partake in this debate. In other words, Hirsch's own son, who already had moved sufficiently to the right to reject any possible, whereas his father was able to say in a private letter written in Hebrew that the statements of scientific fact in the Talmud aren't necessarily correct. His son could not tolerate the statement, and in a public debate on this matter, his father chose not to take sides rather than to express his original opinion. So this is a sort of a hidden attack on... Right. Now let's turn to page 264, an article by Professor Falk.
What happened to the sun that made him turn so much to the right? It's what would it be influenced?
Precisely because of the fact that there was no depth of instruction either in science or in Torah. The notion that you're going to create a cultured German, be a man of German culture, but nevertheless true to the details of the laws, meant in effect that you had to create a mental compartmentalization. It said that one thing doesn't have any impact on the other. And therefore, one thing can't threaten the other. Without any, one has to sort of give an absolute authority to both and does not realize that there's some internal contradiction. But let's turn to Falk and see what he has to say, because I want to get to Professor Friedman's article, which is even more important for us. Most of the children of the Tnua of Torah and Derech Eretz, my page 260, the book's page 264, in our generation, interpret Rav Shimshon Ofer Hirsch's attempt to merge Jewish culture, I mean German culture, that is European culture, or general culture with Judaism, as a tactical means in order to justify his school. And therefore, they say that such a rule doesn't apply in our time. If, according to them, if Rabbi Shimshon Ofer Hirsch would be alive today, then he would support the study of Torah alone if this was something that could be possible in our time. Notice that, for example, even immediately in the Rebbe's funeral, his brother, Rebbe Aaron, gave that same complete distortion of Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy, namely that the Rebbe's support of general culture was only because of the tactical measure which was fit for the ignorant Jews of the United States in the 1930s, but certainly was not his intention. Remember, of course, that's what he said. That was one of the most brilliant speeches I've ever heard, but his intent was to completely distort what Rabbi Soloveitchik's true legacy was.
His grandson was writing in the same general direction, although much more restrained.
Yeah, of course, but his nephew is not restrained. If you read anything that Moshe Meiselman writes, it's completely unrestrained in this direction. So all of this is, as we see, even with Rabbi Soloveitchik, a distortion by the immediate followers of the main themes. According to me, let's go back to the fall. What time do we have? Yeah, I may have to go 10 or 15 minutes over because there are some other important things to do here. According to me, one should see the situation as a Hegelian triad, that is one of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. against the traditional thesis of the sole study of Torah and the antithesis of general culture in its place, Rav Shemshon Harel Hirsch suggested the idea of Torah and Derech Eretz, perhaps a synthesis. But, truthfully, the synthesis is not simply a combination of thesis and antithesis, but rather something completely new, which is above and beyond them. In the case that we had, this should have led to an integration and interaction of Talmud Torah and the general culture. By this means, there would have been some actual change in the study of Torah, as in the study of general culture, and it would show a difference or a chasm between the method of Torah and Derech Eretz and the method of the study of Torah from the traditional way. If Rabbi Shunshin Merel Hirsch would have done that, he would have justified the relative small amount of time devoted to Talmud Torah in comparison with the traditional Torah education by the higher quality as an outcome of the integration and interaction with other modes of thought. But this was not done. And therefore, the children of this generation, when they met the world of the yeshivot, felt that they were lacking in a Torah education, and they wanted to complete it by devoting themselves to Torah alone. When Rav Shamshon Farash mentioned the Chachmei Sfarad, the sages of Spain, as ones who combined the study of Torah in it with a general study, he could have made a convincing case in this instance that indeed their portion was there was to explain the Torah anew according to their philosophical education. This was an example of integration and interaction. That Rav Shimshon Hirsch preferred the method of Rav Yehuda Halevi and the Ramban that explained Judaism from within. He preferred that method to that of the Rambam, who explained it in conjunction with his philosophical understanding. And Rav Saadia Gaon came even before Rav Shamshon before Hirsch, who showed that the study of Torah has to be dynamic and adjusted to the methods of other investigations of philosophy and science. Just as Rav Saadia Gaon used his knowledge of philosophy and linguistics and the sciences in order to explain the Torah, similarly, it should have been true that Rav Shamshon Harel Hirsch should have taken the same steps in the according to the methodology of Chachmei Yisrael in order to dig deeper into the inner understanding of the Torah. The linguistics, literary analysis, history, science, social science, study of religions, all of these could have enriched the study of Torah and justify in that way the more limited amount of time that we were devoted to the sources themselves. But Rav Shimshon Farhesh rejected this method of the scholars of Judaism as a distortion of what he saw as the true study of Judaism. Rabbi Shamshon Farhesh did not believe in the synthesis between Torah and the scientific understanding, or between the synthesis in the fields of higher education. His purpose was to establish an elementary school and a high school in order to create Balabatim, but not in order to create scientists or academics. The justified debate, on the one hand, against the dry scientism of the Rambam and the men of the Jewish Wissenschaft, the Judentum, prevented Rav Shimshon Farhesh from seeing a purpose that the general culture could have filled within the study of Torah. Let's skip to the bottom paragraph. From this it follows that the general culture only plays the role of a cook or a pharmacist, but it doesn't contribute to any dynamic understanding of the Torah. Rav Shamshon Farhesh would not have agreed, for example, to explain anew the order of creation in the Sefer Bereshit according to the theory of evolution or of geology. The knowledge of foreign languages and comparative linguistics would have led to differences in understanding of the Bible, but it's very doubtful whether these changes would have been acceptable to Hashem Shimon Peres. Similarly with history, with social sciences, with comparative study of law or religion, that they could have led to revolutions in the understanding of the Torah and the Halacha. But conclusions in this direction were certainly not according to the spirit of the founder of the Torah in their heads. What did who really want? Well, Shem Shem Farhash wanted to create a community. And he created a community. He didn't want to create anything new in Torah. He believed in the creation of a cultured German gebildete, a cultured German citizen who was also a Jew and kept all the mitzvot. But he had no intent whatsoever to form any intellectual synthesis between the sciences of his day and the Torah of Tari itself. And this is one of the major tragedies in his method. And similarly, if I am allowed at this table to voice a word of criticism, the Rav also did not allow the introduction of general scientific methods, whether it was linguistics, history, and so on, as an ingredient that could be used in the actual study of Torah itself. And this is a common failure. That is a failure common to both of them, because indeed, what use is there for general culture that has absolutely nothing to do with the study of Torah? So,
I said, his teacher that values so highly.
For Chaim Hillel.
Yeah,
well, he didn't follow in the Spetsi for Chaim Hillel. He admired him, but in his educational plan, in the Shiurim, for example, history or comparative law or many of these other things that I don't want to get in. I'm treading into too dangerous ground here because I'm dealing with things that would make me difficult to say. But now let's go one general. So now we understand that in the sense of continuity, Rav Shem Shimon Farhash was a failure. That is, he created Balabatim, but as you say, it was stagnant and it couldn't last. But of course, the general notion of paying a high value to European civilization, well, we know what German civilization actually led to. So intrinsically valuing culture as opposed to the sciences was also a drastic mistake. All right. How much time do I have?
9:21.
Huh?
9:21.
All right, I'm going to run 10 minutes over because it's now important for us to understand. We can understand the failures of this method. We want to also understand the successes, and of course, successes are monumental failure of the yeshiva movement that has developed from the 1950s onward, say over the last 50 years. So let's now turn to Professor Friedman's essay, which is one of the best on this whole matter. This is a recent article. 1998. Okay. So he begins his essay by describing what the situation actually was in Eastern Europe, say before the First World War and thereafter, in which there was a mass movement emigration from Eastern Europe, or movement into the cities, and or the breakdown of the traditional family, where there are many generations living together. Grandfather might have stayed out, when there was a low age of marriage, when people would get married at age 18, there would always be three or maybe four generations living in the same household. But when people would be married at a later age, then the notion of living with two or three generations above you in the same household disappeared. But also, there was just a breakdown of religious observance. So, for example, Rav Sorotskin writes in this quote, when I was a child, I think he was talking about the fights between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. This was back in the good old days, but when I was a child, no traces of this holy war remained. The yeshivot had closed down. and only a privileged few made the journey to visit their Hasidic Rebbe. Children still study in Mecheda, but with no yeshiva, even at the elementary level in the entire district, none of the thousands who became acquainted with the text of the Torah went on to become a Talmudic scholar or rabbinical authority. The youth went straight out into the world from Mecheda and studied crafts or peddling. Those endowed with talent and ability rejected the Torah and embraced the enlightenment. And who would ever have imagined that I would be an exception and leave that environment to study Torah in the great yeshiva? But only because the Lord took pity on me that he rescued me from the land of my youth, my birth, where the flames of the Torah was already dying out, and instilled in me the will and courage to journey to the centers of Torah and to become steeped in it. And if we look at the Chafetz Chaim, again writing, it's the quote near third of the way from the bottom, and if we look closely at our prawless condition as the generations decline over time for a variety of reasons, even those with sons cannot be certain that we raise the practice to Torah. And we, for our sins, have observed that for various reasons some of the sons strayed from the path of the Torah as they grew up, ignoring the exhortations of the parents to walk in the path of the Lord. Thus, even though every man is duty-bound to do his utmost to teach his children in their youth to follow in the path of the law, in any event, the wise man will be well advised not to rely solely upon his sons, lest such reliance be misplaced, which endeavor to inquire and do any more. In other words, don't believe or don't have faith that your children will follow in the religious path. So writes the Chafetz Chaim. If we turn to page 169, the second paragraph, in modern society, even that of Eastern Europe, the social cultural environment contains many and varied socializing agents. Complex systems of formal education, diverse means of mass communication, political parties and youth movements, all of which complemented but often competed with the nuclear family. Moreover, from the very outset, there was a close link between modern secular socialization, economic modernity, and socioeconomic mobility. Traditional Orthodox parents, who sought to ensure the economic status of the children by sending them to modern educational institutions, thereby set in motion, in one form or another, the latter's conditional attitude towards the traditional Orthodox way of life. In the process of migration from the shtetl to the metropolis, from Eastern Europe to Western Europe, the United States and Israel, a process that so many Eastern European Jews experienced, these developments were accelerated. The traditional Orthodox family became even weaker and had difficulty coping, even willing to do so with the influence of the modern secular socializing agents that were dominant in the social cultural milieu of the modern city. For the traditional Orthodox leaders, apprehensive about the continuity of the Haredi lifestyle, this new reality fundamentally changed the rules of the game. From now on, they were obliged to adopt a variety of new quasi-family roles within the parameters of a new voluntary community, one that by its very definition would be separated from and would, moreover, isolate itself from the secular and modern sociocultural environment. The creation and development of this family community, so different in definition, structure, and operation from the traditional Orthodox community, and the seat from which contemporary Haredi society has evolved, is the major concern of this author. The model for the new family community was the Volozhin type yeshiva, which arose in Lithuania during the first half of the 19th century, spread through Byelorussia and Poland after the second half of the century, slightly changed in order to adapt to a new social and political milieu, and finally reached its zenith in post-Second World War period in the Western world, especially in Israel and the United States. The original objective of the yeshiva was to educate and mold a rabbinical elite that would serve the traditional Orthodox Jewish community. However, toward the end of the 19th century, with deepening secularization and disintegration of the traditional Orthodox community as a socio-cultural framework shrinking the way of life of Jews within its boundaries, the yeshiva became an alternative community. Indeed, it was perceived as the only framework capable of preserving traditional Orthodox culture, educating and molding each young yeshiva student to become a lay householder, maintaining his loyalty to Judaism and traditional Jewish values in the face of the challenge of secularization. What made the yeshiva unique as an alternative community was its detachment not only from the secular environment, insofar as it provided an all-embracing residential and educational framework, but also its role in separating the students from their own families. The relationship between the student's family and the institution was inherently complex. Most of those who studied in the Lithuanian yeshivot were external students, many of whom were prevented from maintaining steady and close ties with their families by sheer distance, the difficulty of travel, and poverty. In fact, some of the students did not even manage to go home during vacations. But with the steady deterioration in the economic political condition of each of the European Jewry, the yeshiva adopted quasi-familial roles. It no longer provided only lodging and food, but now assumed responsibility for the students' health and even their clothing, especially those from families that could not or would not support them. Virtually every portrayal of life of the yeshiva student highlights the father figure role of the Rosh Yeshiva. Not only does he appear as a religious intellectual personality of the first rank, but at one and the same time, he was also a merciful father, caring for his students as if they were his children, and at times, perhaps even more than that. Let's skip to page 172.
What year?
He says it started already in the middle of the last century, but only accelerated after the Second World War.
After? Not after the First World War?
No. So the parents, however, were soon to realize on page 172. No, they're in the United States and in Israel.
Oh, but not in Europe.
Not in Europe, no. In the United States and Israel. In Europe already this thing began to develop, the notion of separation from family, and the notion, but remember the number of students in the yeshivas, in the grand yeshivas in Europe, was extremely small in comparison to the population. The explosion took place after the Second World War. The parents, however, were soon to realize that in effect they no longer had much sway over sons who, in going on to study in yeshivot, were now being re-socialized within the framework of a different form of family community, in the spirit and traditional of yeshiva heads. Some documentary evidence of the tensions between parents and the son whose character has changed as a result of yeshiva studies appears in the writings of Binyamin and Zev Jacobson. I'm referring to the sons who studied at yeshiva and returned to their parents' home during vacation. Sometimes they come home absolutely certain about the halacha, over-scrupulous in the observance of the commandments. They arrive with ideological views that are foreign or at least strange to their parents. The understanding father should not belittle the son's behavior or theoretical approach. On the contrary, he should consider him to be a son who surpassed his mentor. This holds true even if the father is himself knowledgeable in studying yeshiva and kesh. Even when the parents' tradition is correct and firmly based, they must be very careful not to criticize the outlook or behavior of their son who has returned from yeshiva, having learned to serve the Lord differently from his parents and so forth. And I'll say and so forth also. Let's turn to the bottom paragraph of the next page. Let us return to the two passages quoted above, beginning with the second. Moshe Scheinfeld, who was at one time a member of the kibbutz affiliated with the Agudat Yisrael Youth Movement, and who later became a disciple of Rav Avraham Yeshayahu Karelitz, the Chazon Ish, was a rebel at heart. He sought the transmutation of the Haredi world that emerged between the two world wars. Scheinfeld believed that it had displayed weakness in dual struggle against modernity and Zionism, and many within it have a sense of inferiority vis-a-vis Zionism. This Haredi world took the easy path and sought to become integrated into the Zionist state after its establishment. He therefore called for a revolt against the Haredi parental generation, which neither in its way of behavior nor its ideology lived up to what in his view were the original and true Haredi ideals. For him, the schism between fathers and their sons who studied in yeshiva was a blessing. Those yeshiva students and those young women graduates of the Beit Yaakov Seminary who were ready to marry them in order they should continue studying were idealistic heroes. In short, Scheinfeld despised the parents and admired the young revolutionaries. Jacobson, who was part of the Buddhist Israel establishment, came from a completely different social background. Born into the banks of German neo-orthodoxy and later influenced by the original religious approach of the leading Lithuanian yeshivot, he served for many years as a rabbi in Denmark and Sweden. His religious cultural world, that of neo-orthodoxy, formerly an important but not the dominant element in the Buddhist Israel, hardly made its presence felt in the second post-Second World War Haredi scene. Jacobson sensed that the revolt of the yeshiva students, instigated by the heads of the yeshivot, were actually directed against himself and his life. Though deeply hurt at the insult inherent in the sons challenging their parents' tradition, especially their scathing disdain for the latter's inferior religiosity, Jacobson and many others like him accepted this with a degree of indulgence and understanding, perhaps even with appreciation bordering on admiration. These persons who had survived the struggle to halt erosion in religious and traditional practices that was evident all around them, and who had lived in constant fear lest the process of erosion infiltrate their own homes and sweep away their sons and daughters, were undoubtedly relieved to know that their offspring were under the influence of heads of yeshivot and great fellow sages. When all was said and done,
From the traditional Orthodox perspective, this option was clearly preferable to the alternative, abandonment of the traditional Orthodox way of life by the sons and daughters. The yeshiva community could now rejoice in complete victory. The biological family, for all intents and purposes, had no answer to the challenge of its sons and daughters, and at times didn't even attempt to respond. Given the thorough secularization of the surrounding social, cultural environment that characterized the modern Western city, the Haredi family, in effect, abdicated its role in shaping the world as children, transferring responsibility to the heads of the yeshivot and to the principals and teachers in the Beit Yaakov seminaries. This laid the foundation for the formation and development of the Haredi society of scholars, the size and extent of which are far in excess of the sum of all of the yeshivot in Eastern Europe from the end of the 19th century until the middle of the 20th century. The society of scholars and yeshiva family community are therefore a totally modern phenomenon, a direct outcome of the development in Western Europe and the United States after the Second World War of the modern, secular, and affluent society. Only in the framework of that society did the Haredi family find itself completely isolated in the face of a secular, even hostile, social-cultural environment. Furthermore, only in modern societies has the family lost most of its function as an agent of socialization to other agents, such as schools and the mass media. At the same time, only within the context of an affluent Western society and welfare state could yeshivot and other encompassing Haredi institutions mobilize the enormous financial resources necessary for the continued and stable operation. However, in order to guarantee the continuity of the Haredi society as a society of scholars, the yeshiva family community had to grow and extend itself, and thus become a total community that covered all stages of the life cycle. Today, life in this community begins in its kindergartens, continues in the Talmud Torah elementary schools, where the school day is longer than in most schools, and then in the elementary yeshivot, the great yeshivot, and the kollelim. A young Haredi man who grew up within the yeshiva family community will have his first meaningful contact, if any, with non-Haredim only in his late 20s at the earliest, when he will already be married, in most cases the father of four or five children. Some might argue that the yeshiva family community effectively encompasses the whole life cycle of all Haredim, because the Haredi ghettos that exist at the margins of the major cities maintain and promote many of the same functions. The origins of the yeshiva family lie in the traditional Orthodox Jewish society of Lithuania. Following the Second World War, however, with the migration of the surviving remnants of traditional Orthodox Jewry to the West, the yeshiva community became the dominant pattern for all Haredi societies. Moreover, even amongst the Hasidic groups, the yeshiva community merged fully with the Hasidic court structure and contributed to the rebuilding and growth of these courts, particularly in the great secular cities of the West, enabling them to flourish to an unprecedented extent. Obviously, the Haredi Society of Scholars, which is based on the multiplicity of yeshiva communities, is not a homogeneous society. On the contrary, it is a heterogeneous society split into an array of yeshiva communities that are interrelated in a complex and a multifaceted manner. While they do share common interests and mutual trepidations, there is a fierce competition among them for dwindling financial resources, as well as struggles for status and prestige between various groups and leaders, all anchored in their variant sacred traditions as developed earlier in the original Eastern European settings. Moreover, as the yeshiva family community has developed and expanded, it has deepened the gap between it and the secular environment within which it thrives, and upon whose resources it depends for its maintenance. Transformation of the family community into an all-encompassing framework that meets the various needs at all stages of the life cycle, from the kindergarten to the kollelim and the residential ghettos, demands continuous and growing resources, most of which are supplied by Jewish society at large. Thus, a Haredi yeshiva family community is becoming increasingly dependent economically upon the surrounding society. Such a dependence has, of course, far-reaching social and economic implications, a detailed discussion of which is beyond the scope of this article. However, one cannot evade the question that must be disturbing to those interested in the maintenance and stability of this unique community. Are there no limits to its growth and entrenchment? In my view, the new reality that is currently unfolding suggests that, precisely because of this community's stunning growth and expansion, its capacity for survival is seriously in doubt. You write last year?
Crazy. What a crazy final statement.
Why? You don't believe
it? You've been hearing it for years. Huh? It says it's been
south by the... Yes, but how many generations can it continue?
What? We've been hearing this for years. We're going to support them. There's now three generations of them.
the great grandfather.
Because the father is in the corner too. Some of them are getting out of his,
First of all, he's primarily talking about the Israeli situation.
Yeah, well, no, well, and he says also that their welfare depends upon the surrounding community. That's right. So they're all making debating all that.
Who's making
the remaining community?
They're not making
it at all. No, they're not making.
60%. You have 300.
They work in the banks.
They do not. 60%. It's not true.
It's only 60%.
60% of the households within the 300,000 or so Haredi communities in Israel, 60% of the households are headed by fathers who are full-time coal miners. 60%. They get support from the government. The government pays them to study in the coal. In America, most of them are in food stamps.
I'll tell you, Jacob, my son-in-law's related to some of the Jacobs in town. And they were all of this Haredi world.
Right. And, okay, now so now you have a situation in which, say, the leading posek of the Haredi world says not only are you not allowed to look at television, okay, I can understand that, but you're not even allowed to talk about or think about the space program. In other words, this is a community which on the one hand is cutting itself completely off from modern society, and on the other hand is becoming increasingly dependent on modern society. And the difference between Professor Friedman and me is that Professor Friedman has an emotional attachment to these communities and feels that one should... We both agree that some crisis has to occur. He's attempting with all his means to try to ameliorate the crisis. In other words, provide some means of educating them so that they can be employable and trying to avoid an explosion. My view on this matter, which I've expressed many times, and gets Weinstein very upset, is that there should be an explosion. The longer that we wait and have the community, now the Haredi community represents 1/16 or something like that of the population in Israel. It's completely supported by the state, but it's growing at, say, 4 times the natural rate of growth of the rest of the society. So what?
Like this social security system in the United States. Less people able to.
The point is, you've created a monster, and I have no emotional attachment.
There is a small flip side about the population growth from that element. Then I think, you know, democracy will eventually take its root, and there will be a non-Jewish government in Israel, and then it'll be very clear that they'll cut off funds to that.
No, first of all, you're thinking that there will be an Arab majority? I doubt that very much. We just had an immigration of 1 million Russians. Whatever you might or might not like about them, they certainly don't love the Arabs. They may not be Jewish, but they don't like the Arabs. Love the Arabs.
But they're not increasing very much because they only have one child.
But you have a sudden increase of 1 million. That's a big number. And you'll probably have another mass. The immigration from Russia has not come to an end. It's slowed down a bit. But the situation that has been created, wherein you found a Judaism which is completely self-contained, as completely rejecting any influence of the outside world and is not economically self-supporting. I mean, it's true. If you go to a place like Williamsburg, all of a sudden there the Satan Marcus didn't work. I don't know what percentage of them don't work, but I recently had to pay a shipper call to a widow of a Satan Marcus, you know, there's a
And the model in the U.S. is very different because the model here is more self-sustaining because it has to engage with the modern
world. But a lot of those communities are on social welfare.
A lot of them are on social welfare, but still only about 5% of them are headed by people who study in Kollel in full time. I'm not saying that all the heads of households
they work in Shiva, don't make any money either.
Right. But the situation, on the one hand, anti-intellectual, anti-idealistic, anti-integrationist notions of anti-elitist views of the conceptual Hirsch did not succeed, and in part led to the development of this elite, in quotation marks, society of the Society of Scholars, which is not economically viable. And we're in for some interesting rough rides in the foreseeable future. Now, several things. Remember, I'm going to be traveling for the next 3 weeks, so that we know Shiva for 3 weeks. Secondly, all of you had a copy of the first draft of this, and I benefited from many corrections that you made. But this is now the second draft, and I'm in no great rush